For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Sarah Lytle, who is our UC Divinity School intern this year. And so, Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you all for a wonderful session of sitting and for being here. So it was a big weekend. A lot buzzing around in my head and heart. So I'd just like to offer a few reflections, and hopefully they'll be of benefit. I would like to talk this evening about the first noble truth, the existence of suffering. In his first sermon, the Buddha said, "I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering." Or he was reported to have said that. And how often I rush, I think a lot of us rush to the end part of that, the end of suffering. Yes, there's suffering, we get it, we feel it, I don't want to look at it anymore, I'm here to get rid of it. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, and it's a very human response. However, there's a reason I think that the existence of suffering is the first truth and is the first half of that single thing. So as much as I want to get rid of my suffering in the long run, I notice that I want even more to not feel it while it's here right now. And I'd like to talk about one particular form of suffering, of sadness. Sadness has lots of associations for me, lots of feelings that get layered on top of it. I feel it in my chest, that constricting, it's hard to breathe kind of feeling. The past few months, I've been working through a lot of my own sadness and grief. A lot of it having to do with my family. And my father has been living with a chronic illness for the past 10 or so years. That has recently gotten a lot worse. And so it's been a complex and a chronic grieving process, as well as a complex and chronic illness for both my mom and I. And it's recently been taking over more and more of my life. I've been noticing it in my body and on my cushion. And the pain of watching someone you love suffer, and the encounter with the truth of illness is, I think, familiar to many, if not all of us in this room. It's really painful. And I've been looking a lot to my tradition for some guidance and for some help. And the Buddha gives us a lot. So that's how I ended up back at the Four Noble Truths. So, sadness. As part of my schoolwork right now, I'm studying divinity, which sounds very magnificent, and in lots of ways it is. But we've been doing a course on spiritual care and caregiving, and have been reading Mark Epstein's work, The Trauma of Everyday Life. If you haven't heard of him already, he's a psychotherapist, psychoanalyst, as well as a Buddhist, and does a lot of work thinking about those two traditions in conversation and what they can offer one another. As I was kind of in the midst of this, I came across this phrase: emotional pain is as fruitful an object of awareness as anything else. So I've been learning about how much I avoid allowing emotional pain to be my object of awareness. It's been coming up a lot on my cushion, and I've been working with it. To be more accurate, sadness has been coming up, and that's what I've been trying to avoid feeling, and that's what I've been working with, is the avoidance of it. Whenever it starts to come up, I try to displace it with something else. Whether that's intellectualizing or finding a solution or really anything lately has been preferable. And sometimes it's good to take a break, but I think I've been causing a lot of other suffering and trying to avoid it in the process. And I think that's fairly resonant with how our culture treats sadness as well. It's not something that you should have. If you do have it, you should get rid of it. And definitely don't tell anyone about it because they do not want to hear about it. Or at least that's what I think everyone else doesn't want to hear about. So I grew up about an hour away from the Pacific Ocean in Northern California. The water is cold and gray and salty and sandy. The sky is often overcast. It's harsh. Where I live, it's not the kind of rolling Malibu beaches and beautiful water. It's beautiful, but in a very striking way. And I loved it growing up. I would play in the waves until my legs were burning and then numb. And just for hours and hours, I would play in the water. But my mother gave me one rule: never turn your back on the ocean. The delight and the power of the waves, of letting myself be carried in and out of the shore, was very intimate with the danger of the water, specifically of rip currents. If you grew up near a body of water or by the beach, you'll be familiar with these. My mom grew up in Southern California, so she was very adamant that I learn about rip currents before I ever set foot in the ocean. If you don't know what these are, they're powerful, localized, and narrow currents of water that move directly away from the shore, cutting through the waves and running out to sea, kind of like a treadmill going away from the shore. It's stronger near the surface of the nearest the surface of the water where a swimmer might be traveling. And it's very dangerous for swimmers because often you panic when you realize that you're being carried far away from safety and heading quickly out into the deep water and into the sea. And the danger really arises is when that panic leads to trying to swim against the current and trying to get back to shore. You tire yourself out very quickly and you can't swim anymore. So every time we went to the ocean, my mother would ask me, "What do you do if you find yourself being pulled out to sea in a rip current?" "Swim parallel to the shore or diagonally, angle toward the shore, and don't try to fight it." I would kind of give the answer very quickly just so I could go out and play. But I think there's a lot of resonance to this, and there was a reason why she repeated it so often. But by swimming parallel to the shore, you travel through and across the current, kind of against that instinct to get back to safety, to go out of this stream that's carrying you towards the deep. The ocean and water have a lot of symbolism in a lot of different traditions, and for me, this has been a very striking metaphor, because I feel like I often react to sadness like it's a rip current. The danger feels immediate and imminent. I'm going to be pulled out to sea. I'm not going to come back from it. I react very quickly in fear and in panic and swim against it, expending all my strength and wearing myself out. No, do not let that in. Not that sadness. Swimming against the current and trying to stuff happiness into that sad-sized hole takes all the energy I have. And the more tired I get, the more old coping mechanisms arise, knocking at the door, promising freedom. I look to things to take me out of that experience, to distract myself, to avoid it. And this isn't bad. Distraction can be really helpful if used skillfully, but it's not always helpful. Sometimes I slide into perfectionism, sometimes denial. And I've noticed that the way I've been responding to this situation with my parents and my sadness surrounding it is spending a lot of energy trying to fix it and to make it unsad. Because as long as I focus my energy on fixing it, on finding the right answer to this that is going to make it less painful for everybody, there remains an illusion of some ideal situation that's out there, that if only I can find it, I will get it, and it will be better. And the more comfortable option of self-criticism and anger with myself that I can't find the solution protects me from the truth, that I can't fix it by being the perfect daughter, by being the perfect Sarah. This is really part of what being a human being means, is dealing with illness and death. Having a body that's vulnerable and experiencing both love and loss. And this is just going to be hard. It's going to be difficult. And it really sucks. And that's fine. Pema Chodron offers a really wonderful reflection on this tendency to protect ourselves. She's a wonderful teacher to go to when I'm feeling sad or feelings that I don't quite know what to do with. She writes, "We think that by protecting ourselves from suffering, we are being kind to ourselves. The truth is, we only become more fearful, more hardened, and more alienated. We experience ourselves as being separate from the whole. This separateness becomes like a prison for us, a prison that restricts us to our personal hopes and fears, and to caring only for the people nearest to us. Curiously enough, if we primarily try to shield ourselves from discomfort, we suffer. Yet when we don't close off, when we let our hearts break, we discover our kinship with all beings." So our broken hearts can be our practice. My broken heart can be my practice. When we feel love, we feel sorrow, and we feel sadness. Our impermanence is intimately intertwined with our interdependence. So what does Zazen offer for feeling bad? Turns out a lot, at least for me. And recently, the most important part is helping me be with my own pain without trying to turn it into something else. To be with the First Noble Truth without trying to sanitize it, without trying to get away from it. To ask myself the question, what might it look like to yield to sadness and let it soften me? Rather than resisting it, what if I let it move through me? What if I move through it? What could it look like to approach the sadness with gentle awareness, with kindness? To say, yes, this is sad. And I'm not talking about not seeking healing or change or trying to relieve ourselves and others of suffering. I think that's really important. But I think that the first step is acknowledging our pain rather than covering it up. And I think that that's one of the scariest things about asking for help with our pain and reaching out to others. Because once I have to acknowledge that there's pain. And by sharing it with someone else, they acknowledge it too. And it's very hard to run back an hour later and say, just kidding, I'm fine, because they probably won't believe you. So it's a practice of acknowledging our suffering and of learning to be with it. So the path we're on as humans can be a path of acknowledgement as well as of healing. And I think part of the reason why it's hard to acknowledge being sad or being any one of the other emotions that are less than tolerable is because it means that I'm vulnerable and not invincible and not endless. All things which the Buddha has taught us are part of being a living being. And I think it's really from there that we can see the resilience that we have, the resources for healing, and the capacity for insight within us. So that's the beautiful flip side of this. And when I was talking with Taigen about this, he mentioned that the first noble truth includes not only the truth of our sadness, but also the truth of our ability to face our sadness, our ability to sit upright in the midst of it. And it's a noble truth because it contains within it this reminder of our capacity and our ability to face it. So I'd like to close with a reflection by Norman Fisher, who's one of the teachers in our lineage. And he writes, "In difficult times, the key thing is to turn toward the suffering instead of trying to figure out how to get rid of it or paper over it with all kinds of positive things. We need to learn how to turn toward suffering, really take it in, find the meaning of it, and let it open a path for us to a new life. There's nothing more beneficial than being able to be present with the breath and with the body to what's happening when we are suffering, without flailing all around in resistance. That's the beginning of a new path." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for sharing your own experience of sadness and vulnerability with all after all. He said, does anyone have comments or responses or questions or comments?
That was a very beautiful talk. Thank you so much. I hope we can learn from you how to be better listeners when someone does share whatever you were talking about, because the listener has to follow the same advice you're giving yourself, which is to not try to fix it for you.
Yeah.
It's such a temptation, and it's so frustrating. It tells more about your brain and have them tell you, well, you can do these three things, and then you'll be this book, and see the movie.
Yeah.
All right. I'll try someone else. Anyway, that is advice, because I think sometimes people try to share with us and we're not taken enough to what they want and hearing the heart the way you did.
Here's the suffering of the world. So compassion is just to listen, as saying, to the sorrow and sadness. Yeah, we have some, so you're saying,
inputs, most recent necessary to not figure out how to fix it, but really just listening to our own or someone else's sorrow is in itself
Okay. It's been a long journey path. I think it's one of those situations that's just very unclear, kind of what day to day will be like or what month to month. He's also a Zen practitioner. Both my parents are Buddhist, and it's been a really beautiful way to kind of connect together through this, is through our practice and our shared language, and kind of see, you know, the bodhisattvas are really wonderful lifeguards to kind of offer ourselves up to and to look up to. And I think for both my parents and for me, they've been really a good resource, is to look to the compassion of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas as really sources.
You know, I found it really hard to, with someone that I care about who's very sick, who's dying, it's just speaking to them about how they're doing and how they're feeling better in a natural way. Either you just want to dance around it, or have something seen or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how hard I will resist
talking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Me too.
We all need to get trained.
Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. You early on, you mentioned the feelings of sadness, and that's something I'm always interested in hearing about, how people practice with what they feel, because I think, knowing from my own experience, my feelings, my physical feelings, are often ignored a lot.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of emphasis for us to not pay attention to that. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that.
I agree. And I think the practice of sitting brings those really into relief, sometimes very uncomfortably, because you can... I feel it very much in like kind of my throat and my chest, and it's that hard to breathe, hard to relax into the space of my body, really, because it's... I think because that relaxing into it means really feeling it, and I'm often kind of bracing against that sensation of sadness. But I think breathing like into my belly and just letting that flow through has been a way to address the physical for me. And kind of the reverse too. Sometimes I notice that my body knows before I do that I'm feeling something.
One of the main gifts of Zazen is it gives us a chance to actually feel what we feel.
When
you're sitting, just practices to, apart from our ideas of who we are, The world isn't all of our agenda, it's just to feel this body, this mind. Information, of course. Awareness.
And I think there's something really powerful about being in a sangha and practicing that practice, because there's a sense of support there that even if, you know, you're not explicitly sharing what's happening inside, kind of all in the having people next to you is, I think, really helpful. For me, encourages me to open my heart to what's happening.
And we're each dealing with different things, and different kinds of sadnesses or joy sometimes too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I sometimes recommend that you both of us want to, how does it feel? Feel what you feel.
Or maybe it's a Buddhist practice where someone sort of dedicates or takes on one's suffering on behalf of all beings, mm-hmm. and for especially other folks having that ailment. I was ill about a year and a half ago, and the illness tends to really kind of acutely ill, and it kind of focuses you very much on yourself. And I found it kind of liberating to every once in a while be able to think of other folks having the same affliction. And it really is opening.
Yeah, absolutely. Tonglen is one of those practices. And I found that very helpful too. Thank you for sharing that. For kind of what we've been talking about not fixing it and kind of like being able to be with the pain, and because it's really kind of going against our natural tendency to avoid the pain, but by taking it in, it kind of works different muscles, I think.
So we have a well-being dedication list that's very long now, but so we chant it only 2 monthly sittings because it's dedicated to particular people. So if you have someone who you would like to add to that list, you can let me know or let Laura know or email and fill in your comment or Sarah Stack Robert is on that list, and a lot of folks who probably are on that list. As I mentioned, Sarah's parents practiced in the Tassahara years ago. Robert was one of our teachers. But many of us here, we have people who know who are ill with one element or another. This is part of our life. And if we don't have someone now, we probably will.